Little Exiles is a podcast that explores life following Jesus Christ in South Africa. We want to think deeply about what the Bible has to say about life and talk about what that might mean in the situations God has placed us in. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are not necessarily those held by the host, co-host, or production team. As this is a discussion and not a pure teaching platform, it is up to the listener to engage with the content responsibly.
Welcome to our listeners to another episode of Faithful Exiles. So we will be discussing a very relevant topic, namely politics in South Africa. And our guest today is Professor Nicola de Jager. And she is a lecturer and researcher at the Stellenbosch University for political science. Besides being a prolific researcher, she's also a Christian and a parent. Anything you'd like to add to that bio that I pulled together there?
Sure. I think some of my research areas are South African politics and comparative politics, just to highlight that. Mm-hmm. And I'm also in my spare time, so outside of work hours, I'm a member of the Wilberforce Academy, so mm-hmm. the South Africa Wilberforce Academy. Mm-hmm. And that's really, we do worldview training, and I've been involved in worldview training for a number of years around biblical governance, cultural matters, and also just philosophies and ideas that are entering into our into our worlds, whether mm-hmm. it be at home or governance or whatever. Mm-hmm. So those are the areas of interest that I have. And then also to say, yes, you say I'm a parent, but I'm a mom. So mm-hmm. I'm a mom of two teenage boys. So I think I'll be speaking to some of those things as well from that perspective.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Good. Thank you. Let's jump into the nitty gritty. So from a faith perspective, how's it as a Christian? You know, what is your point of departure into politics? What do you kind of hold in the back of your mind as a pillar when you engage with politics?
Sure. So I think the first thing is to ask who's an authority. Mm-hmm. So I think for us as Christians is, and this perhaps distinguishes us, is that God is an authority. Mm-hmm. So if he's an authority, he's also the source of authority. Mm-hmm. And he's sovereign. So he rules alone and he governs alone and he doesn't need any of our input. Mm-hmm. So he's, because he's fully good, so he's infallible. But he then delegates authority to us. We're speaking about authority. We're speaking mm-hmm. about government and governance. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand, where does that come from? What's the source of it? So the source can either be man or it can be God. Okay. So if it's God and he delegates to us and we're not on the throne, but God's on the throne, mm-hmm. how then does politics look? So if it's delegated to us from a sovereign God who is infallible, and he delegates it to us recognizing that we are fallible, therefore governance and politics has a certain look, and that will be delegated but limited. Okay. So he delegates authority to us, but he also limits it in light of the fact that we are sinful. So that's for me the point of departure. God on the throne, mm-hmm. he's sovereign. Man's not on the throne, but he gets to govern. But his governance is always limited. Mm-hmm. And because he is fallible and sinful, there has to be checks and balances. There has to be balances of power. Mm-hmm. So that's my point of departure. I mean, I think this is something that's, it's also good for people, because that idea that God is the source of authority is that it actually, you can actually sigh with relief. You know, we're not on the throne, but we can go to him to find out what does it mean to govern, because all the guidance that we have is inside of his word. But in that, he gives us value, because we actually lose value when we put man on the throne, because he's fickle. Mm. But with God, he actually gives us value through his son. So people are valuable, but we are fallible. So those two things speak to the limiting of authority, but also that we should treat people with as made in the image of God. And that's, so that really changes and speaks to how we govern.
Okay, yeah? Thank you. Yeah, so pretty much a robust worldview, a Christian worldview present. In terms of South Africa, So we live in a certain setup. Can you maybe explain the electoral system to us? Because we're going to go vote on the 29th of mm-hmm. May. Hopefully everyone goes to vote. Does my vote count? Many people will say my vote just gets lost in the mess of irrelevant parties, or just not going to vote because they think it's a waste of time. They'd rather go to the beach. Comment on the on that.
Sure. So one of the wisdoms of our government is they know that people mm-hmm. might see that we make it a public holiday, the election day. So they purposely make it a Wednesday or in the middle of the week.
See.
Yes.
Okay.
So that it's not on a Monday or on a Friday. So that it's not a long weekend. It's not a beach day. It's actually a purposeful yeah. day to go and vote. So our electoral system, we have local elections, provincial and national elections, mm-hmm. but these elections coming up are the national and the provincial elections. Mm. So the electoral system that we have for both the national and the provincial is called a proportional representation electoral system, or mm. for short, we call it a PR system. Mm. So on the local level, it's different. We have the constituency-based system, or first-past-the-post, together with mm-hmm. the proportional representation, so we have mixed. So we shouldn't be confused from the local, but to, on the provincial and national, it's a purely PR system.
Okay.
So the beauty of the PR system is that it allows for representation. So, and this was well thought through. So those who drafted the Constitution in the beginning in the 1990s, they were thinking, how do we draw the different voices into the governing system? So how do we make people, how do we make South Africans feel part of this democracy? Mm. And the PR system allows for that, because your vote translates into the seats. So the number of votes that a party receives proportionally translates into the number of seats that they receive. Mm. So we have, obviously now when we are voting, we're voting for the National Assembly, and we're also voting for the National Council of Provinces, where mm-hmm. it translates into there. But if we look at just the National Assembly, you've got 400 seats.
Yeah.
So they work out the number of votes that a party needs to receive based on the number of total votes that are cast on that day. Mm-hmm. And then they divide that into the 400 seats, how many votes are required per seat. So, mm-hmm. okay, so just basically, obviously it's a lot more intricate than that. Mm-hmm. But historically, this is meant about, for a seat, you need between 40 and 50,000 votes. So historically, it doesn't mean that's what's going to be happening in these upcoming elections,
sure.
but in general. Mm-hmm. But so the beauty of this is that a party that receives, sometimes people say, oh, no, but it's a smaller party, therefore my vote is, I don't want to vote for a smaller party because it's going to be wasted. And that's definitely also a strategy of some of your bigger parties to say, don't waste your vote. You must vote for a bigger party.
Yeah.
And no, because of that translation in terms of the percentage of the votes that a party receives translates into the number of seats, smaller parties do actually get representation. Mm. So the thing that should be guiding people when they are thinking about who do I vote for is who represents your interests and who represents your values, because you want those voices inside Parliament where the legislation is made, where the decision making is made.
Okay.
Do you want to speak to the parliamentary committees?
Yeah, you mentioned in our previous meeting how it's interesting because maybe you only have one seat of your party in the House, but now that person goes and sits on a committee which is actually quite prominent or quite making important decisions, and now this member, like you said, is proclaiming your ideas or representing your ideas because it's the party's ideas, and then actually having a real impact in, is it legislation or what is it that gets passed in the committees? Is it proposed legislation or?
Yes, yeah, proposed legislation. Okay. So they won't pass the legislation inside these committees,
okay.
but they will debate and discuss them.
Okay.
And it's exactly as you say. So you know, in 400 out of 400 seats, if you're a smaller party, the smaller parties will perhaps have 6 seats or 4 seats or 2 seats. And then you think, okay, so when that final bill goes through for voting, the bigger parties obviously, they will decide.
Mm.
But the real kind of engine room where the legislation and the is debated and discussed is inside these parliamentary committees. Mm. So amongst these, you have so-called portfolio committees. Mm. And the portfolio committees mirror your ministries. You know, so your Department of Basic Education, there will be a portfolio committee for that. Mm. And then they are also, in terms of representation, so on a representative basis, mm-hmm. but generally they're much smaller. So if you're looking at 10, so you've got 10 sitting on a portfolio committee for education,
yeah.
your smaller parties tend to put their top people, obviously, on their list, because it's a party list system. They put their top people on the party list, and they will be the ones with the highest qualifications. They will be, you know, the top quality people in those committees. Mm. So all of a sudden, you might be, instead of, say, 2 out of 400 or 6 out of 400, you are 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10, mm. but you are also the one with the legal background or the expertise in that area, and you become, your power increases. So all of a sudden, you might be the one, the expert in that committee. Mm. And so you can actually really input into those committees, or whether it's, so maybe environment or agriculture or one of those areas. Mm. So the influence of those voices and those interests grows exponentially inside those portfolio, those engine rooms.
That's great. So basically even one seat could make a difference in reality.
Absolutely.
So most parties will, or parties or systems or ideologies will have a certain, let's say, mantra or background or idea where they say, this is the problem. Some other political or problem of man or whatnot, and this is the solution. And they will say, okay, they might not state the problem, some might, but some will just assume it. And then they'll say, okay, we're doing this, and this is obviously their proposal of what the solution is.
Mm.
Can you perhaps mention the, say, top three or three most relevant relevant in our context, parties or ideologies that are about, and what is it that they say is the problem or infer is the problem, and then what they claim to be the solution.
Mm.
And then, on top of that, in hindsight, then as Christians, how do we view the problem solution when we think about politics?
Sure. So underlying, I would call them intellectual frameworks, or another way of seeing it is a worldview.
Yes.
Or an interpretive framework. So actually inside in each political party, or underlying, it's like a foundation, mm-hmm. is this worldview or this ideology, as you speak about, or this interpretive framework. So we tend to see the same problems, because the problems are there. I mean, we've got unemployment, we've got poverty, we've got violence. These are core problems, but based on the interpretive framework or the worldview, the different political parties will approach these differently.
Yeah.
So some of the dominant worldviews or interpretive frameworks that we see, so the ANC, which is the current ruling party, its worldview or underlying framework, so it's not, as one is first say, it's not homogeneous. There are different worldviews that are fed into the ANC, and we can speak to that a little bit later.
Yes.
But the dominant one at the moment would be, coming from the 1960s, a communist influence, but is now translated to more socialist worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that determines or influences is state-society relations. So what role do they see for the state, and what role do they see for the society? And with the socialist perspective is that they tend to lean towards the state. The state will solve. Mm. So you centralize the state. The state is the solution. And yes, they might speak to a little bit to the society, but in general, it's more kind of a regulatory framework around your economics. So around guiding and regulating the economy, much more of a hands-on influential, but in the same way, this also translates into, you see the legislation that they are actually moving through at the moment is quite intrusive. So it's very much so, we will lead you, we will guide you, we're the state, we know what's best. So things like poverty and all of that, it takes away personal responsibility, and it says we will do it with social grants. Mm. So we will deal with something like poverty and inequality and joblessness. So joblessness will be something which will be kind of tagged on the end, because they are solving it through the state, through social grants, through social spending. They put the money into that arena. The other kind of dominant worldview, it would be your more liberal worldview, or I would say that like your second biggest party, the Democratic Alliance, their interpretive framework or their worldview is liberal, but not the kind of progressive liberal that we would see in American type of politics. It's more classical liberal. So it's a less intrusive state, more of a limited state. So that state-society relations is more balanced. More limited state, but and more of a role for society. So we see this in terms of some of their more free market types of orientation. So poverty, there's also a move towards how do we deal with it? Yes, there's some level of intervention of the state, but it's dealt with largely from a market perspective. Mm. So your market creates jobs. Mm. So the state is less regulatory. It takes away a lot of the red tape. Mm. The labor unions are not so involved, and it allows for your small, medium enterprise, your entrepreneurs to be involved and to create the jobs. So again, those are the two big ones, and I'm going to get to what's a more Christian perspective, a Christian worldview. I think also underlying those, if you dig deep enough, you know, when we ask for that, what is that first starting point? What is the underlying assumption? Yeah. You know, who is in charge? Who's the source of authority? Who knows best? Yeah. So with both of them, actually, it's man. So man sits on the throne, man is the authority, man will determine. Okay. And in the same way, like with the, especially on the socialist perspective, that translates into the state. So the state becomes the provider, the determiner, the issuer, the one who determines the laws, the one who provides, almost that the state becomes like God.
Yeah.
So the other problem with your more liberal and more, when you start leaning more to the progressive side, is that it's your laws become man-determined. So in terms of what is the culture, you become moving with the culture and you shift with the culture. So where does this leave us with a more Christian perspective of that? What is that underlying worldview? Obviously, one needs to go to the Word. What does the Word say? And the Word tells us to be careful. It says in Colossians, beware of vain and deceitful philosophies based on man and not based on Christ. So we should always be, what does Christ say? Mm-hmm. What does Christ say for governance? And so this would be, I always used to think it was a classical liberal, but it's conservative. Mm-hmm. So your conservative interpretive framework or worldview recognizes that there are certain traditions that remain the same. Certain governance structures, and if again we go to the state-society relations, that the state has a role, the state has a place to play, the society has a role, they have a place to play, and in that, your traditions, things like family, are very, very important. They're the building block of society. It's not the state, it's the family, and that's a society role. In the same way, it sees a role for entrepreneurs and the free market. So it really kind of starts to limit the role of the state vis-a-vis society. And it creates this divide, this public-private divide. What is the state's role? The state's role is justice. It's supposed to execute justice. Mm-hmm. And then what is a role for society? Well, inside an environment where there's safety and security provided by the state, people will begin to flourish because businesses will start to open. You won't be afraid to open up past 10 o'clock at night because you know that when you walk into your car, you're going to be safe. Mm. You know that you can operate in various areas because you know that you're going to be safe. And so this starts to create jobs, starts to create a vibrant society. So if the state does its role, then society can flourish. And this is more of a conservative idea in terms of more the traditional, what has worked, but it's not unchanging. So it recognizes that there are some times when you need to adapt, and to adapt It's incremental. It's never like a shock, you know. So you're more kind of going on to the Marxist one, which we haven't touched on, but a more Marxist worldview is revolutionary. It's shock. It's completely break it down, destroy. And unfortunately, never seems to want to build back up and doesn't show you, but it's always a destructive. Whereas your conservative says, okay, this is not right. We're going to fix this and we're going to tweak it. But there are certain traditions and truths which remain firm and steadfast and unchanging.
Okay, so that's a lot to think through. So from a liberal perspective, you're saying that because they're quite... They're dancing with the culture,
yes,
that they take those things on maybe too easily, too quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas the conservative won't necessarily ignore the culture, or maybe, but they'll, if it's a Christian conservative party or mindset, they'll see, okay, cool, so the culture is pointing at these things which apparently are wrong or dodgy or unfair, and then maybe then change the institutions, but less haphazardly than maybe the liberal mindset.
Yeah, I like that what you're saying with the kind of dancing with it. You kind of move with the culture. But there's some certain things which are, for a Christian conservative, something like the sanctity of life. You know, that's unchanging.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Sanctity of life is unchanging. You don't move with the culture, where the culture says, no, it's, you know, my body, my rights, my freedom. It doesn't move with that. It moves from the basis of sanctity of life, and that's unchanging. So to give you an example there.
So based on the various ideologies where we discussed, say, the liberal and maybe the classical, the conservative and maybe what the ANC is doing and a bit what Marxism is doing, how would you define government in our democracy and maybe what the biblical worldview, how would it define government?
Government. Mm-hmm. So the word government is interesting if one looks at its history. So if we go back to the Webster, one of the earliest American English dictionaries, the Webster Dictionary, I think it was 1828. So if you look at the word government there, it speaks about control and restraint. And that's the first definition. Then it goes into the individual's control and restraint of their tempers and their character. And then it goes into the family's government of the family structure. Then it goes into the civil government and the laws and the regulations of the civil government. So what was interesting is that I think it was until World War I, whenever you spoke about your public government or your state, it was always prefixed with civil government.
Okay.
So clearly define it from these other spheres of government. After World War I, then that civil fell away and we just use the word government. And so what has happened is that these other spheres of government, instead of being running parallel to each other, they have kind of shifted underneath the state government.
Okay.
And the expectation is it's almost like the state government has come and enveloped like the family government and church government and other civil society and even like the market and those types of government has come and is overarching. So where we are sitting today is that it's that state, which is almost, and we see it with the Bella Bill at the moment, where this encroaching into the area of authority, which was given to the family. So there are many scriptures which speak to what is family government. You know, it's a mother, a father, and children must obey their parents, wives submit to the husband. So there's an order in terms of family government. Inside the church, there's an order, there's an eldership, there's accountability inside the church. And then inside the government, we see there's guidelines inside the word which speak about the executive, the legislature, and your judiciary, the separation inside there. But what is happening at the moment is that the government, the state government, is starting to legislate into areas which were actually not these.
Yeah.
So things like the family. So, and using the institutions like your education and your school systems to start to actually infiltrate into those other spheres of government. which were never theirs, which are not their role. And I think what happens in society is that as that happens, people give over their freedoms. They give over their authority as well.
Yeah.
And you make the decisions for me. You make me happy. You provide me with the work that I want. You discipline my children. You raise them. And that's actually kind of a giving over of responsibility, which is not a biblical perspective in terms of governance.
Absolutely. Would you, if you hazard a guess, would it be that the government is nearly always wanting to extend its levers or its like tentacles into all, or put its fingers in all the pies, and we as humans citizens need to be aware of that and constantly keep our guard up? Or do you think it's that citizens have kind of relegated their authority and that the government's pounced on that as a result?
I think it's both.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it's both. I think we, you know, we use the word kind of state and civil government, and in that way we forget in a way that is people. You know, so somehow there's also with the more social understanding or socialist understanding, there's a sense that somehow the state is this, I always use it, it's like this benign Father Christmas. And you know, the benign Father Christmas has this goodie bag.
Yeah.
And he hands out all the goodies. But nobody then starts to ask, well, where do the goodies come from?
Yeah.
And, you know, what happens when that goodie bag, you know, there are no more goodies to be handed out? As opposed to there's taxes, and those taxes actually come from people who work, and they are the stewards of public funding. So the funding is not theirs. They don't have this endless goodie bag. It's your and my labor. You know, we work and we pay taxes. It's the fruit of our labor that they are now handing out, and then create this idea that it's. They are, you know, the provider, but they're not. So, I kind of digressed.
I was just asking about, is it citizens that have kind of relinquished their authority, or the government that's encroached?
Yeah, so that again goes back to that human nature. You know, if we think that we are inherently good, then you're going to say, fine, you just control and you do everything, because you will you will govern in the interests of everybody. But if you recognize that we are actually inherently sinful, and that human nature is not is got a bent in it, and the bent is not always good, and then you're going to limit those who are governing in those positions. And then hope that they will do well, but it's I know it's kind of a negative way of framing it, but it's one way of seeing it is, how do you limit the evil in us? And that's where that delegation and that limitation of the different spheres of authority comes in. It's that limiting the potential evil in us. And those who fill the state is, again, it's not just Father Christmas, it's human beings. I think it's can't remember who said it, but he said it's not as if when we vote that there's this kind of like Narnian wardrobe, that you kind of go into this Narnia on the other side. The people who start on this side you voted in is just as human this side as they are that side. And so we always need to have those checks and balances inside. The other side is what you spoke to is this, it's easier to just give over and let somebody do it for you. But what are you giving over when you do that? And you're giving over the decision-making, the responsibility, and your freedoms. And when you do that, eventually the state will start making all the decisions for you. And you realize that, oh, I can't live where I want to live. And we just need to go and look at these totalitarian communist systems to see what happens. You can't study what you want to study because they will tell you what you can study. You can't live where you want to live. Eventually, you'll be limited to who you can marry, or even if you can raise your own children. You know, so this is the type of thing that we forget that we have inside the political system that we have, which is a democratic system. And a democratic system says that we are to govern. We are the ones who are to govern through representatives, but that doesn't mean you vote and then you step back. You actually are to govern through being more active and engaged, but also limiting it through doing what you are supposed to do, doing your job, raising your family, being involved in your community, not waiting for the state to do it.
Many people have said the South African constitution is one of the best constitutions or one of the better ones. Can you comment on it, since we are a constitutional democracy where the constitution is actually the highest law, if I can put it like that, pros and cons in terms of from a Christian worldview or as a Christian, what would you say are the pros and cons?
Sure. On a political side, there's a beautiful word inside of our constitution, and that's called impartiality. And we see that when it speaks to the public service, it speaks to the judiciary, it speaks to your Chapter 9 or statutory, independent statutory bodies that includes like the Auditor General, the Public Protector. That word impartiality, you'll see in the word where the Bible speaks about those who judge to judge on a nonpartisan or impartial basis.
I see.
To judge fairly, you know, to judge the rich and the poor in the same manner, not to favor the one or to favor the other. And so that principle of impartiality it's a value that's deeply embedded inside of our constitution. So the expectation is that our judiciary, when it exercises justice, will do so with, like, you know, the Lady Justice who has the band around her face, her eyes, not her face, but around her eyes, so that she won't be guided by, who's sitting in front of me? Is this a rich person or a poor person? Is this a man or a woman? What race are they? She doesn't judge on that basis, but judges on the merit of the case. And so that is such a beautiful principle, because it's also a principle of good governance. To govern impartially, to govern not on partisan interests, but to govern in the broader public interest. So that's something that's really, really good. I also think the electoral system in terms of the PR said in principle it must be proportional representation. So we can have mixed, but that proportional representation is important because it brings in the variety that we see inside South Africa, the different voices, the different interests. And then it protects that as well inside of the Constitution. And we have a Bill of Rights and we have constitutionalism. So nobody is above the law. So no president, no party, no individual, no one who's more clever, or nothing makes you above the law. Everyone is subject to the rule of law. So those are, for me, very, very important principles that we have. And our Bill of Rights sits inside of the Constitution, which is also unique in that, those protections of our freedoms, freedom of conscience, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, sits inside the Constitution. Where I think it's concerning is that Father Christmas element comes in. So we have enormous socioeconomic rights inside of the Constitution, which sound nice.
Yeah.
And we would really, in a perfect world where, you know, the state was actually the source of all resources, and it could just hand out, it would be wonderful, but that's not reality.
Yeah.
The reality is that actually we are supposed to work and we're supposed to have independence from the state and we're supposed to enjoy the fruits of our labor. There's something very dignifying about work. And these handouts create such a dependence on the state. So on the one side, it creates this dependence. It creates this, on second, it also creates this idea that the ruling party is the one that is handing these out, as opposed to, no, they are using the fiscal budget, which comes from people's taxes largely, and that is being distributed. So these socioeconomic rights are enormous, and the expectations, it's created these expectations on the state, which are not even feasible. So we have a very low tax base that, in terms of those who earn enough to actually pay tax. I speak under correction, but it's something like 5% of the population. So you're looking like 3 million who earn enough to contribute to be tax employer tax payers. Mm-hmm. And then you've got something like 16, 17 million receiving social grants. It doesn't take much to figure out this is not going to work, but yet it's in the constitution. Mm-hmm. So they are actually constitutionally obliged to meet the socioeconomic wants and needs of society. And again, that's if you look at the state society, it's then it says, oh, state will do it, as opposed to, no, there are different actors in this country, and they have different roles and different functions and different responsibilities to play.
We're all familiar with the symptoms of the problems in South Africa, specifically now in 2024, which is roughly 30 years after the big 1994 elections. Symptoms being, you know, poverty, unemployment, lack of education, insufficient public health care, etc., etc. Can we say it's a consequence of poor governance where our constitution wasn't enforced or done correctly? Or are we expecting too much of the constitution? Like you mentioned now, the idea that there's so few taxpayers actually comparatively to those who have sufficient needs, say, for grants. Is it fair to just blame the ANC, because that's what we see in the current political the arguments? Say the DA and most of the other opposition parties will say, oh, it's the ANC, it's bad governance, etc. Should we be surprised? Should we be laying the blame on the ANC, or is it actually the constitution is just expecting too much? Or yeah, could you maybe speak to that? I mean, the ANC has been in power for since 94, very much so. So it is justifiable to want to blame them for a lot, but is that going too far?
So it's both again. Mm-hmm. I think you're right in the sense that this constitution is like a wish list, which is unattainable and shouldn't it's placed a burden on a sphere of government that shouldn't actually have that burden. Mm. So the socioeconomic expectations should not rest with the civil government.
Yeah.
Firstly, if we can divide that, your biggest creators of jobs are your small, medium enterprises. There's the research shows this.
Okay, it's not more than like mining and big hospitals and such?
Absolutely, because okay. What happens is they tend to mechanize wherever they can. Okay. But your small, medium enterprise, they have got a lot more wiggle room and they employ. But we've got lots of regulation which actually hinders that from happening. And they would, if they were released, we could sort out our joblessness in this country. So what has happened is that those expectations placed in the state, and if we had to unbundle it, you know, unbundle it from that burden, mm-hmm. So Romans 13 speaks about that the state wields a sword.
Yeah,
and that's justice. Mm-hmm. So if it focused on that, it's focused on its policing, it focused on its justice system, its prosecution, and those aspects, mm-hmm. and really focused there, and then allowed for cutting back the red tape and allowed for your jobs to be created by your entrepreneurs, your small, medium enterprises. And the concern with your bigger businesses is they tend to create monopolies and they go into corporatist arrangements with the state.
I see.
And then there's this kind of strange relationship that starts to develop, whereas you want a level of independence and then, you know, a little bit of keeping your lane, the business keeps in their lane, because business can also move out of its lane. And then in terms of the socio side, so the poverty alleviation, children, orphans, actually that responsibility lies with civil society and with the church and with other religious institutions. So if we did that function, but one of the challenges is that we're so heavily taxed that you don't get to choose where your money goes. Mm-hmm. So the state's taking the money is not necessarily the best steward or decider of where that money should go. Mm-hmm. I think as Thomas Sowell said, he said it's this kind of arrogant sense that they are the holder of all knowledge.
Yeah.
But actually knowledge is dispersed. and the different spheres, and that's where the beauty comes with the different spheres, that, you know, the job creation, and they have a dispersion of knowledge. They also know what works, what does society want. They're more in touch with it. Mm-hmm. In the same way, the church, you're closer to where the needs are, you're closer to where the orphans are, you're closer to where the homelessness is. It's not impersonal, it's personal. Mm-hmm. But if we could actually extract the tax away from the state, limit it, and allow for those other spheres to grow through stimulating the economy and through also giving into civil society organizations, it could shift and change things completely.
Okay, so you would definitely say a state overreach in terms of overtaxation, but also over expectation of what it thinks it can do.
Yes.
And its ability to provide, its ability to take care of those in need, where it should actually have focused more, say, on justice.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in that, there's also a place where people have started to expect the state to do it.
Yes.
So yes. One of the concerns that we have in South Africa at the moment is a conflation of democracy with governance. So democracy is a regime type. It's how is power accessed. It's accessed mm-hmm. through elections, and it's representative. Mm-hmm. And then inside a democracy, you are a citizen, so with rights and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. If we distinguish this from an authoritarian regime, so how is power accessed in an authoritarian regime? Was through violence, through overthrow, through military coups. It's not through elections, and you're not putting in representatives. And you're also not a citizen. You become a subject.
Yes.
So the important thing is for South Africans to remember that we still are a democracy and we're a citizen, but it brings with it, yes, rights, but also responsibilities. Mm. You are actors. You're not just acted upon in this kind of a system. Then what you're conflating this with governance. Now, governance is once you access public authority or you access that political power, how do you use it? And in whose interest do you use it? So I do think there's an overreach of the state, there's over-expectations of the state, but at the same time, I also think the ANC has a lot to answer for. Mm. So they've actually taken this, and if we go back into the history of the ANC, as I said before, the 1960s was pivotal for the ANC, where they were largely underground, their main leaders were exiled, or they were incarcerated on Robben Island. They were really a party in need of a friend. And the Soviet Union came in.
Need of a friend.
They were in need of a friend, and they were the friend, indeed. And true, they were. So they gave them military support, they gave them financial support, they gave them material support, but what was the exchange, there was an ideological exchange. Mm. So there was exchange in terms of ideas. And one of the core ideas that came through there was the Vanguard Party. And the Vanguard Party is a Leninist idea that the elite will govern, the elite will rule, and they know best. It comes together with this whole idea of the false consciousness. Mm-hmm. So your working class, we're delving a little bit into the mm-hmm. Marxism, but they thought the working class, the problem with the working class, why they were not rising up is because they didn't understand how oppressed they were. So you need the Vanguard Party to help them understand their false consciousness and mm-hmm. To liberate them from it. But this idea of the Vanguard Party, it comes into a government and then it says, no, we govern alone. We're the elite. We know what to do. And you have false consciousness, so you don't really know. So we will make the decisions for you. Mm. With that comes also the ideas of a partisan government. And this is also Lenin's idea. So that non-partisanship, it does not come in with Marxism. It's the dictatorship of your working class, the proletariat, which means the Vanguard Party. So it's deeply partisan. It's not nonpartisan. So the ANC comes with these ideas and they come into government. They feel they should govern alone. They slightly tolerate to an extent the opposition because they're in a democratic system and because there are constitutionalists inside of the ANC. So there's this kind of disdainful kind of, oh, we're going to let you speak. And even at like public hearings, they go through the motions because it legitimizes the democracy and the system and legitimizes them. But do they really listen? Do they really take it on board? No, why should they? Because they're the Vanguard Party. They know. But they also come in with these ideas of a partisan government, and we see this with the state capture under Jacob Zuma, using the state resources for private ends and for personal ends and for personal connections and to further the party. And unfortunately, I think what we've seen, especially in the last 15 years, is that the ANC has put the party over people.
Sure.
So what is in the party's interest, not what is in South Africa and what is in the public interest. So it's constitution, overreach of the state, and a political party with ideas which give it the sense that it knows best, it should rule, and it can do whatever it wants with the state resources.
Mm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Is always when I think of the ANC, I think of the like a patronizing individual. They nearly laugh at you know, when they get questioned, oh, why did you do this? They kind of laugh it off, or they like preach to the people. And yeah, like you said, the opposition parties, they voice their concerns, but yeah, they don't really take it on board. They just kind of think of them as irrelevant and carry on So yeah, clearly this election is significant. Some have even said, you know, the most significant election since 1994. Mm. I trust you agree with that statement. Mm, is there anything you'd like to add to that? Or
I'm very excited about these elections. I think there's just a sense of a general sense of these are important.
Mm.
You know, so you get this kind of feel that people are recognizing that we need to mobilize, that we need to vote, that things cannot continue the way they are continuing.
For sure.
And one of the ways in which we can make an impact on that is through our elections. And that's punishing at the ballot box. You know, that's how a democracy works. If those who have access to government do not govern well, you don't let go of your regime, your democratic regime, and the freedoms that you have. You punish the governor, you punish whoever is governing. And so if you see the levels of trust, you look at the World Value Survey, the Afrobarometer Survey, the levels of trust in our government and in our president and in our institutions of government have plummeted. They are at the worst levels we have ever seen. So there's deep distrust. And hopefully this is going to translate into people actually mobilizing and voting. So I get the sense that we're sitting on a kind of like a cusp again, where we get to do this again, you know. So 1994 moment where we get to okay, let's have another go at this. It didn't go, we didn't do it so well, but we get another opportunity. And so hopefully people are sensing that, and I sense it also in young people. They are doing voter mobilization. I see it with my own students. They're starting organizations.
Okay, cool.
They're enthusiastic. They're teaching people why to vote, why you should vote. So, yeah, there's like an enthusiasm there.
Mm, a certain excitement or buzz in the air.
Yeah.
So last week you gave a lecture on biblical civics, and you spoke on the political side of things. You said there were a few things that we should seek or that are important from a biblical worldview. And you mentioned social flourishing, economic flourishing. That was the other speaker that spoke. I think we've spoken significantly about that already. But then political flourishing, and then praying. I thought that was a good catch-all.
Absolutely. But start with that one and end with that one.
Yeah. Could you maybe comment on social flourishing a bit? I think we've spoken significantly about the economic, and we can maybe touch on political flourishing. But what do you mean by social flourishing?
So I think my point of departure there was this, you know, we find ourselves, especially as Christians, in an environment that so often we feel is like foreign. I mean, what is the title of your podcast?
Yeah, Faithful Exiles, so exile aspect of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that speaks to that exiles that we, and I remember like praying about it and saying, well, what am I supposed to do in this environment? It's so foreign in so many respects. And the letter that was written to the exiles by the prophet Jeremiah came to mind, and writing to those who were living in Babylon at the time, the exiles. And that's that Jeremiah 29, and where it starts with what are you supposed to do? Well, it says build homes. Then it says plant your gardens. And then it says marry. And then it says have your sons and daughters marry. And then it says seek the prosperity of the city in which you find yourselves in. And then pray for it. So for if it prospers, you too will prosper. And I think for us as exiles, these are good guidelines and speaks to a flourishing. So if you think about build your homes, plant your gardens, marry, it's speaking to that socioeconomic flourishing. Flourish where you find yourselves and that social flourishing, and then seek the benefit of the city. So we are actually called to be a blessing and to see flourishing around us. So again, what's the source? Where do we find this flourishing? And so we look to the word, and what does it say? But there's research actually which speaks to social flourishing. So social flourishing is kids with a good education, it's going at furthering your education background and becoming a meaningful contributor to society. It's in terms of life expectancy, there's a lovely measure of social flourishing. Your life expectancy, your calories that you take in, what kind of food are you getting, education level. So the research which show what creates for flourishing, and this is obviously won't always go down well. It would not be culturally acceptable.
Yeah.
but if you want flourishing, the two things are the idea of the family, and there's research that is growing in this area about the importance of the two-parent family, where they speak about, there's a book called The Two-Parent Privilege, and studies, economic studies, which has shown that, and again, we must be very cognizant that life happens, and that there are obviously single-parent families, and they are doing the very best that they can in their circumstances, and we as a church need to support them and help them. But it doesn't take away from the empirical research, which your best life chance for a child in terms of finishing, their schooling, doing posts or secondary or tertiary education, getting a good and stable job, and staying out of jail for the boys.
Yeah.
Not falling pregnant for the girls.
Yeah.
The best indicator for that is a two-parent family, being raised in a two-parent family. And again, obviously not every two-parent family is perfect, but in general. So when they do studies of the young boys and young men that are found inside of our prisons, the key thing that comes over again and again, they grow up in fatherless homes. There's no father figure for them.
Yeah.
So that's the one, is family. Family is the basis of a society and a two-parent and the two-parent privilege. The other one is sexual restraint. Again, not very popular, especially in our culture.
Absolutely not. No.
And then, but there's research on this. J.D. Unwin, he was an Oxford and Cambridge professor, and he did a long-term study on societies and looking at sex and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And where he found that those cultures, and he looked, I think it was about 84 societies, and he looked over a period of 500 years. So he was, an anthropologist and, more in the historical side as well, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then he looked at those societies which flourished. And when he was looking at flourishing, he was looking at things like art, music, engineering, architecture, education, all levels of flourishing. Mm-hmm. And he found that the thing that actually made for a flourishing society was sexual restraint. And the highest indicator of a societal flourishing was chastity.
Mm-hmm.
And then fidelity. So waiting before you're married, and then when you're married, you remain faithful.
Mm-hmm.
That led to human flourishing. And on the other side, societies break down when there isn't that restraint. And he said where it goes to three generations, and after three generations, the society is likely to collapse. So some of the others have done work on this, as Francis Schaeffer, where he looked at the Romans and Pompeii in particular. They were very kind of sexually unrestrained and perverse, and you started to see the crumbling of those societies.
Okay, that's interesting. So you say that sexual or not having sexual restraint won't necessarily punish the culture immediately, but maybe two or three generations later, and then it's a real crumbling. It's not just a oopsie, oh, we should go back to what we were doing, but rather things end quite miserably.
Yes. So it's interesting with this idea of so-called progress. So the term is used that we were progressing, and this takes us back to those worldviews where we spoke about your more conservative traditional cultures, and now this is progress. So it's progress if I am a more a liberated, so-called liberated life, those without boundaries.
Yes.
We have these free marriages where you can kind of have relationships outside of the marriage, or you have these swing parties, and it's so-called, sounds like progress and liberated. But if you go back to older societies like the Roman society, they had these kind of more freer relationships, but they also had things like, I'm going to be quite provocative now, but if I see the move that is happening in terms of what is sexualizing of children through some of the education systems, and you see where those ideas come from, many of those were advocates of pedophilia. So
in the Roman society back then?
So the Roman society, they had, the men would have young boys who were their sex slaves until they reached adolescence when they could marry, and then they were allowed to marry. So we look at this and we go, oh no, it's so cool, but this is that sexual perversion is something which is not necessarily progress. It's, I would call it actually a return to some of the ancient societies, how they used to live and didn't protect children and didn't protect families, didn't protect a woman. It was free and open. And now we've moved away from that to protect families, to protect children, to protect women, because actually fidelity inside of a marriage protects all of those things. And that is the conservatism, that's the tradition of the family, but it's not necessary progress if we break that down.
Yeah, for sure. It's regression. Yeah, so South Africa then, now as we know it today, what would you say are the biggest threats to its flourishing? So obviously there's some people are on the more radical side, maybe think civil war might be a reality, or maybe those who are a bit more relaxed are just indifferent, that their indifference might cause a certain crumbling, or maybe we're concerned about mega powers, you know, China or USA exerting influence. There's maybe the idea of controlled speech, or as opposed to free speech, or maybe state-controlled education. So what is it that, if anything else, you would try and mobilize people towards fighting or standing up against?
So there are many things. I think the one which we have touched on is that we cannot continue along this trajectory. We, in the sense of this level of state intrusion, has got to be restrained. So the beauty of an ineffective state.
Is it ineffective?
There's a silver lining here.
Yes.
So the silver lining is it might be aspirational to control everything, but if you can't, the beauty is that where there's a void, things will come in and fill it. And so we're starting to see this privatizing of the state-owned institutions, like Eskom, and that's really quite exciting, and we have to go in that route. So it has of its own it's actually started to crumble in terms of its levers of control. And if the research in dominance, party dominance, actually shows that that extensive state-owned enterprises and the control of the state and resources, which bolsters dominance. And when you break that down or you start to privatize it, then the dominance also breaks, because you don't have the the patronage, and you can't hand out those resources anymore. So we can't continue as is, and I think we are going to, of necessity, move away from that. Mm-hmm. So the privatizing, the getting the market involved, and so we can create jobs. Jobs is number one. We're at 40% unemployment. It's not. It's just not sustainable. Mm. And we. And so that for me is critical. You've got to get people working. It gives them independence from the state. It stimulates the economy, but it's also dignifying.
Yes, absolutely.
So people get dignity when they work, and we need people to understand their human value and dignity. So we need to also see that. That's number one. The other one, which I'm particularly concerned with because I've been involved in it, is in the education system. Mm. And what is happening is that there's a level of idea intrusion in through the education system, which is intruding into the sphere of the family and the family authority. So we see it with the Bella Bill and the centralizing of your education system under a central government, provincial, and then the national government, and then using that to bring in curriculum which would be counter to the values of the society. And we see this with the initial attempt to bring the comprehensive sexuality education program in, again internationally funded, and now we see it with the early ECDP, early childhood development program, and funded by the Belgians. I think it's something like 40 million that has come in externally to target young people between 0 and 7 years, their formative years. Mm. Deeply concerning, because at that stage, that's where they are creating their identity and bringing in ideas which are postmodern, reality denying, and going to create enormous confusion in young people, but at the same time undermining parents. So you see that with the Bella Bill, saying that young people can get abortions without actually asking their parents or telling their parents or their parents consenting to it over the age of 12. And this also, that the teachers are not supposed to confide in the parents. So you undermine the parents. At the same time, you are molding kids into an ideology which is rather radical and postmodern and outside of biological reality. And I think this, and then the comprehensive sexuality education, it's just bizarre. They say we're not sexualizing the children. I'm not even comfortable to tell you what is in those scripted lesson plans.
Because, and this is 0 to 4 year old.
So the comprehensive sexuality education is your primary and your secondary.
Okay.
But the early childhood development plan is your pre-primary,
which also has sexual content in it.
It starts to create that idea of separating sex and gender.
Yes, okay.
And then in that you get these drawings, like the gingerbread person and then the unicorn, and then it's also like sexual expression and sexual desire and things like that. I mean, telling a 2-3 year old that they can express and have sexual feelings. It's just so age inappropriate, and you are creating an interest in something which they are way too young to possibly handle. And I think this onslaught against the youth and the young, and those Marx even said that the mind of a child is like clay, it's malleable. And it's in the research, they know that's where your identity forms. So if you get children at that age, you can mold them in accordance with your worldview. So that keeps me awake at night.
Yeah, I can imagine. So it's quite interesting to think that there's Belgian money coming in to support this kind of a thing. It feels like a complete overreach, and it's not even, you'd expect that maybe from the state, but not funded by some external country. Obviously, it's a complete overreach of the state in terms of teaching things that, so that's the one thing, teaching things that aren't what the parents or society actually wants or needs, but then also that idea of, once you confuse children, young children and teenagers on sexuality, like what you mentioned earlier, how restraint and nearly a conservative method of sexual constraint and fidelity now goes out the window, and now you have that link to what you said about after roughly 3 generations, there's a deterioration of society.
Yeah.
So there's nearly, it feels like the state, like, or that the education system is starting a fire in the house and kind of walking away and thinking it's a good thing. In light of many things that are interesting, what books would you recommend, or what are there any certain YouTube channels or websites or books that you would really recommend that, say, the layperson, not the professional political analyst, or just normal people like me, what would you recommend that's really useful? Maybe in general, but also specifically.
So in terms of podcasts and insightful kind of information, but from a conservative, very conservative, PragerU, they do a variety of sometimes in-depth interviews with people who have knowledge, inside knowledge, and expertise knowledge, and I think it's really, really insightful, PragerU. And they also do some short kind of, I don't know what the term is, but things like the global warming and climate change and stuff like that. They engage with those kind of topics, and also the gender ideology and the transgender issues. So very, very good information there, PragerU. In terms of books, so if someone's interested in civil government and government in general, one of the best books that I've read is called The Ruler of Kings, and that's by Joseph Boot. And then if someone wants to see a bigger perspective of where can this really go, not just for South Africa, but in terms of what's the global zeitgeist, you know? What's the global move? And this touches on my other area of interest, academic area of interest, is the totalitarianism, which is the total control of society. And we've seen that in the 20th century, and we think that maybe that's not going to happen again. But if you read the book by Rod Dreher, Live Not by Lies, he interviews people who came from those totalitarian systems. And we see a lot of the alarm bells going off in terms of, and one of it is that control of speech. We see it with these so-called hate speech bills and acts that are coming out. When you control people's speech, you are intruding in terms of not just the political, but the social, and into the heart and minds of people. And so Live Not by Lies by Rod Dreher, if you want to get a sense of the bigger zeitgeist. And then, you know, a classic, I think, is Francis Schaeffer's How Should We Then Live? Also kind of looking through the ages, what are the lessons learned, and what happens when a society doesn't actually build on God and doesn't build on Jesus and doesn't build on his word? And when you actually, it's like a shifting sand. So that's also a really good book. And then if you want more of the kind of meaty book, in terms of that social flourishing and economic book, this is not necessarily a Christian book, but it's got very good research, is The Two-Parent Privilege. I think it's Melissa Kruger, but I stand under correction.
So we've talked a lot about how we have the Constitution and how we can inform ourselves, and now we can be very aware of the things going on. We can maybe read the news or listen to the radio. But now, as citizens, we often, in South Africa specifically, feel we're kind of at the mercy of a crooked government. And we feel, I often find myself feeling apathetic, or some people despair, or some people might turn to lawlessness. You know, oh, why should I pay my taxes? It's going to get wasted anyways. What are legitimate ways in which we can actually, as citizens, you know, like turn the knife and put the knife in in a way that's appropriate? Obviously, lawlessness and civil disobedience is one thing, but it's not necessarily the Christian call always. What are let's say legitimate ways to engage in these things?
So, as a first off, not violence. So I think we can engage in civil disobedience, and we can engage in protest, but and there are many examples in the Bible of this. Just Paul, when he was told not to preach, and immediately starts preaching the word again. So when it contradicts the word of God, then then obviously the word of God stands. So there is a place for civil disobedience and a level of protest, but never destruction. So never the destruction of any kind of property or hurting people. So I think we need to just make sure that we distance ourselves from that. Okay. But there are some very constructive ways in which we can engage. And this is also exciting. So one of the ways is engaging with the public hearings. So any bill that goes through first needs to go through public hearings, like the Bella bill. And I know that this really stirred a lot of parents. So there are different stages. So you'll see there'll be different calls, whether it's sitting with the National Assembly or the National Council of Province. So each time it goes into these different houses within our parliament, there are these public hearings. So you get to engage, you get to go and speak. And so I encourage people to use those opportunities, go and speak to them. But there will also be a call for submissions regarding bills. And a great resource here is called Dear South Africa, because they actually collate all the submissions. So the submissions go through them, so they keep record of it. Mm-hmm. So the parliament, whichever parliamentary committee or is overseeing it, can't then go, oh, well, we hardly got any submissions, because there's a track of it. So all of our bills need to go through a public process of engagement, and we can engage there. Then there are other ways in the different spheres that we can get engaged. There are wonderful civil society organizations that are engaging for Cause for Justice, which is definitely engaging around what's happening inside the schools and the curriculums and so forth. And then you've got 4SA, which is Freedom of Religion for South Africa. And they need funding. So they need financial support, because they're taking the battle in terms of on the legal side. Mm-hmm. And we know that legal proceedings are very, very expensive. I mean, some of the other battles with Cause for Justice is around pornography and those things which will undermine a society. Mm-hmm. But they need funding. So it's an easy way, if you've got a business, to fund and support these types of organizations. There's also tax rebates and that for it.
Okay.
And then as a parent, school governing bodies is probably one of the best ways that you can get involved in your local community and inside the schools. So numerous ways. And I think our civil societies do wonderful work, and our churches do wonderful work, and we need to support them wherever there's a heart and a passion. If there's a heart and a mercy, or mercy passion, maybe for the homeless, let the church, the civil society get engaged there. Don't wait for the state to do it, because it's not their role. It's our role and our responsibility. And in that, you actually start to push back its hold over society and the dependency that society has on it.
Yeah, so nearly if you make as if they're not there and you just carry on, then they become a bit irrelevant and
absolutely,
their power becomes nullified.
Yeah.
I think the obvious one, which you now didn't mention, but I think which we all already discussed, is voting, obviously.
Of course. That went without saying, I hoped, but maybe it should be said.
Yeah, but maybe also one thing I'd say is freedom of speech is the other, I think, big thing. I mean, the fact that we can call out injustice and in theory not be persecuted for it is actually also a massive benefit that we have.
And what you're doing, I mean, this type of thing in terms of the podcast, allowing people to hear different perspectives, but also for people to inform and educate themselves, I think is really important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe we can close this off and say, what would you say is the general call for Christians in terms of civic activities? I mean, we've touched on it quite a lot already, but in general, what is our call as Christians? Is it to nearly just be Christians? Like you said, I mean, something like a soup kitchen is a civic/church engagement where you show your concern for the needy, and you don't turn a blind eye to it. Maybe just a comment on in closing, what as Christians are general the activities that we can engage with.
Yeah. So I can't remember which emperor it was, but one of the Roman emperors was particularly concerned with the Christians. And the reason why was because the Christians were the ones where society went to when they were in need.
Mm-hmm.
So they met needs where the sick needed help. They were the ones who looked after and cared for the sick, where the babies, I mean, they also had, they discarded babies, but they discarded, they didn't want them, they would just leave them, and the Christians would take up the babies. They cared for the widows and the orphans. And this caring nature, this outward service of society started to contend with the emperor's power. So we think that those things don't count, but they do. So I think we don't underestimate whatever that call is that you've got. Is it a soup kitchen, as you say? Is it a book club? Is it something like that? You know. So how are we salt and light in society? And we don't always have to do what others do, or we can support what others are doing. But we need to engage and be the salt and light in society. And we go back to the Jeremiah 29, which says, you know, seek the prosperity of the city in which you find yourself. Pray for it, for if it prospers, you too shall prosper. But our intention should be to be salt and light in our society, to be bold. If not so, why wouldn't the Lord just take us back? Why are we still here? And in everything that we do is obviously to glorify Him and bring Him glory.
Mm. Thank you. That's perfect. I think on that note we can end. Thanks a lot for your time. Prof. Nicola de Ocher, I think we've all learned a lot. I've learned a lot. And I think we can definitely go into this next election and this next, let's call it era, whatever the outcomes of the elections hold, as Christians with our heads held high and with a certain hope and a knowing of what we can do. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jean.
Thank you.